Ken Boa's Spiritual Study Series brings you a teaching journey through the Gospel of John. This is chapter 9.
Begin, as we always do, with a prayer. Lord, we thank you for our time together, and we ask that you would guide our thoughts as we reflect upon your word. We pray that we would be people who not only hear your word, but also apply it in our lives. We pray in Christ's name. Amen. We're up to John chapter 9, which is one of my favorite chapters in the gospel for various reasons. And one of the reasons is because it is a dramatic dialogue at its best. It's a great, really overview of terrific dialogue and understanding about the way the presentation of Jesus becomes more and more evident. As we see it through his titles, we see progressive revelation about the person of Jesus. And in a very real way, through the eyes of this blind man, in effect, we are also forced to see Jesus and decide how we will respond to him. So there's a progressive development in the revelation of this one. Now, keeping in mind that this is continuing the narrative that was previously found in John chapter 8 and in John chapter 7, namely, the Feast of Tabernacles. We're still at the end of the Feast of Tabernacles. It's a seven-day feast that was going on. And on the last day, the great day of the feast, they would light up these huge lanterns. In fact, they had these four, they were sort of like pots that they had, and these were four gigantic stands. And each of these four gigantic stands had four large golden bowls, and these large golden bowls would be filled with oil, and the wick that they would use, it sounds bizarre, would be the undergarments of the priests. So they would turn them into wicks, and they would illuminate, so you had these 16 lights that would be done in the courtyard of the women so that all had access to that, and it said that when they lit them up at night, all of Jerusalem would be ablaze. It was a brilliant thing because you have to keep in mind, imagine what it would be like to live in the ancient world when you had no street lights, you see. All you had was candles, and so it would be a brilliant thing for them to see. And the Festival of Tabernacles related to two themes. One was to water, and the other one was to light. And as we've said before, Jesus then, and you recall in John chapter 8, uses the imagery of him being the light of the world. And so we see this theme being picked up also in John chapter 9. Look at verse 8, verse 12. Jesus again spoke to them, saying, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in the darkness, but will have the light of life." So if you contextualize that, it's very, very clear that Jesus is, in fact, using what's physically around them at this period of time on the last day of the feast of Tabernacles in autumn, in the fall, and he's using this image to show that he himself is a greater light than that which Israel has yet known. And he is the light that shines out in the darkness. It's an image of John 1, too. Remember, the light would shine in the darkness, and the darkness could not comprehend it. Themes of light and darkness run all through John's gospel and his literature, and also, of course, through the scriptures. So you can do a wonderful study just from Genesis and through Revelation of the motif of light and darkness and how all that ties together. But this claim that we have here is that he is the light of the world. Now, what we're going to see is four revelations of Jesus. In verses 1 to 12, we're going to see Jesus as a man who is called Jesus. So the first thing we'll see him as is a man who is called Jesus. That's all the blind man knows about him. And then we're going to see him learning more about him. He's going to realize he's a prophet, beginning in verse 13 to 20, and going to 23. And then he's going to acknowledge that he's a man of God in 24 through 34. And finally, he's going to regard him as the Son of Man, and he worships him at the end of the chapter. So there's a progressive development in the theme of the titles of Jesus. In fact, another way of looking at this is the theme, I haven't written down here. Listen to these titles that spill over each other, creating a message for the study. He's called a rabbi in verse 2. He's called Jesus in verse 3. He's called the light of the world in verse 5. He's called the one who was sent from God in verse 7. he's from God, 9:16, and then he's a prophet, 17. He's called Christ in verse 22, and the Son of Man in 35, and then Lord in 38. So there's a developing theme, a motif of who this Jesus is, which is extremely important, because John, in doing so, is really, again, forcing us as readers to discern where do we stand with regard to this Jesus. Because if you'll go ahead again to chapter 20, you'll recall John's purpose statement when he said that these things that I've selected, the signs I've selected, the last verse of chapter 20 and verse 31, these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ. Now remember, the word Christos really referred to the anointed one. It would be Mashiach in the Hebrew, and it meant the one who was anointed. And that is a term, a title laden with implications because of the fact that the Jewish understanding in the Hebrew Bible was a progressive revelation of the power and the authority of the Christ, the Son of God, who would also be the Son of Man. And that by believing, you may have life in His name. Considering these double meanings become particularly evident in this dramatic story. Because the double meaning will be the theme of light and darkness, that those who claim to have light actually are in darkness. And the one who is born blind, they believe he's born blind because of some sin his parents have done or because he was just born in sin. And that way their religious leaders are saying that this man has no spiritual discernment or any visual acuity and that the two go together. The irony, of course, will be by the end that Jesus will be telling them that you're the ones who are blind. Because you claim you see, you actually do not see. You're still in your sins. So there's going to be an ironic turn about, just as there was, by the way, as Jesus faced his accusers and then turned it around and actually began to judge or to accuse them of their hardness of heart. There are themes that go on here. In fact, we have a lot of parallels between those two chapters. In chapter 5, there's a man who's healed on the Sabbath. And the temple leadership raised questions. Similarly here. Their concern, the temple leadership, is that this man is healed of his blindness, and it happens to, again, to be on the Sabbath. And they're more concerned about that than that the man is healed from his blindness. And so we see a theme of questions, and then in both cases, chapter 5, and in this chapter, Jesus finds the man and encourages that man, and then he enters into an extended debate with Jerusalem's theologians about the meaning of his authority. At the end, both chapters have that kind of structure. And one of the synoptic structures that we find then is that you have a healing account then followed by a narrative of discourse and then some confrontation that takes place with it. And of course, we know that this theme of Jesus healing blind people is quite common in the Gospels. It's actually disproportionate, isn't it? There are some reasons for that. But it's a kind of a hallmark of his ministry. You'll see him healing the blind man Bartimaeus in Jericho, and then two blind men in Galilee, a blind man without speech elsewhere, possibly in Capernaum, a blind man in Bethsaida, and one more in Jerusalem following the cleansing of the temple. So it's quite intriguing that we see all these. So what we see, of course, in this chapter, as in other chapters, is our Lord performed miracles to meet human needs, but also as a proof of his messianic claims and as a means as well of conveying spiritual truth. None of his signs were decontextualized from his claims and from his life. All his signs had a purpose. They just weren't just thrown in for fun. And the greatest miracle in this chapter, though, as we'll see, is not the opening of his eyes, but the opening of his heart. And so that'll become the theme that we'll see. And in this understanding of development, then, we want to look first, let's take a look at the first seven verses to see about the actual account of the man who's been blind from birth and is healed. And so it goes on to say, after verse 59, when they picked up stones to throw at him, and Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple, you recall he'd made the claim that before Abraham was, he is. And before that, he said, unless you believe that I am, you will die in your sins. So he had very, very strong claims along these lines. The claim, ego eimi, and the Jewish leaders understood that, because if, in fact, he was not who he claimed to be, then it would have been blasphemous, and they would have been warranted to stone him. As he passed by, and by the way, the Gospels are masters of understatement. It just says he hid himself and went out of the temple. No easy task when you're surrounded by hundreds of people. Just suddenly hide yourself and walk out of the temple. But in any case, he did this. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind?" Now, this is a very important question, and Jesus' response to this will have a great deal of bearing on the issue of the problem of evil and of suffering. Jesus answered, "It was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but so that the works of God might be displayed in him." Now, there's a bit of a struggle here. Many of our translations don't, I think, perhaps get this right. And there's a purpose clause that begins with the Greek word hina, which would mean so that. And that purpose clause can be it can actually be related to what follows, or it can be related to what is previous. My view of this is that it relates to what follows. If that's correct, here's how you'd translate it. It would be something like this. "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but so that the work of God might be displayed in his life, we must do the work of him who sent me while it is still day." You see the difference? It's big, because it's not saying that God made this man blind and therefore now I'm going to use it. But he's saying, in order that the work of God might be displayed in his life, we must do the work of God while it's day, because I'm not going to be here on this planet doing these things for a long time. I argue this, that evil and suffering is clearly a consequence of a fallen world. And that consequence relates to a number of things, and one of course, is the primary thing is the spiritual warfare that's all about us. And in that spiritual warfare, we discover then that there are forces of evil at work. But there's also the force of evil within our very lives because we are born in a context. All of us are born in sin. Psalm 51 makes it very clear. In sin was I conceived. And so from the very beginning, David acknowledges that. But in other words, we are born into this world, and the solidarity with our progenitor, Adam, means that we are now people who carry on that disease, that fatal disease, that flaw, from generation to generation. And the problem that we have is that while we have biological life, we do not have spiritual life. And so the need for the good news of the second birth, of a spiritual birth that gives a spiritual life then, is really underscored by the evil that we see in this world. In a disease-death environment, because things are not as they were created, we are not as we were created, we've changed ourselves. That Genesis 3 account is exceedingly central. To understand what human nature is about in relationship to God's intention, you've got to understand then how Genesis 1 and 2 then precede Genesis chapter 3, that we are not now as we were originally. We have changed ourselves, and as a consequence then, we are no longer what God would have called very good. Behold, it was good, 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 and then he said very good. And so there's a distortion, and from that point then, it was needful then for God to launch a program and a process by which Messiah himself would be the one who would come. And the mystery of all mysteries is that God himself would underwrite the cost of human sin in this world. It's a deep and profound mystery that God would see the cost and actually take it upon himself. It's unique. Again, I've stressed this before, but I'll stress it again. Only in the biblical vision do we see a God who suffers for his people, who sacrifices for his people, who so wants us that he himself will suffer and actually take upon himself our own sin. Utterly unique. And the world, not being a friend of grace, will always try to turn that thing around. It's the one thing that really is going to be utterly set apart from human endeavors to arrive at religious systems. Because all human endeavors always work out to be a system by which we somehow achieve, or hope we can achieve, appeasing God by our own merit and effort and attainment. What I call bootstrap theology. You're trying to lift yourself up into heaven by reaching down and pulling on your bootstraps, as if that's going to make you rise up to heaven. That's about what it's about. And so the scriptures then emphasize a very different orientation. But Jesus, I want you to notice, doesn't answer the question head on, does he? He says, it was neither that this man sinned nor his parents. Interesting thought, this, that he was born blind. How would he have sinned if he was born blind? He would have been around. Would he have been around prior to this? Is it a pre-incarnation concept? Is it his parents evil? No, the answer is always this. We never are right to blame a specific disability on a specific sin. We have to be very, very careful here about that sort of notion. We are often tempted to say, this is because of that. You do not know. In the economy of God, it's not so simple. And that's a simplistic understanding. But we understand, really, that ultimately, all physical problems in this fleeting world are a consequence of the fall and a consequence of spiritual warfare and rebellion. But ultimately, we look ahead and we realize that He will take away every tear from their eyes, that death will no longer be, that there will no longer be any disease or sorrow or suffering or pain. The former things will be removed, and behold, He will make all things new. The older I get, the more I treasure that hope. Because I'll be honest with you, I'm getting to the point now where I'm beginning, where I have to finally admit that, you know, I'm more than halfway. I should have admitted that a long time ago. But the fact is that if my hope were not in that, I am for some reason wired in such a way that I can't help but think about these questions of origin, purpose, and destiny. I can't not think about them. It troubled me when I was a kid as well. I try not to think about them. I try to distract myself and divert myself. There are many people, though, who have an amazing skill at being able to avoid those fundamental questions of who am I, why am I here, where did I come from? I find that to be an astounding thought because I can hardly identify with that. All my life, I've wrestled with that. And for me, then, to be at a point where I had no meaningful answer to the problem of death, I would be really in a despairing situation. Probably the only thing I could do would simply be to medicate myself in one form or another. And what Pascal described as distraction and indifference are the two strategies of the human race. He predicted this in the 17th century. Is it not more true now than ever before? That the basic strategies that I see people following, especially in our culture, are two. Distraction. Are we good at that or what? It's called entertainment. It's called mindless entertainment and deception and delusion and indifference, a posture of indifference, almost a kind of an assumed skepticism. And we have that also characteristic of our times when people really posture in such a way as they suppose it doesn't matter. They're not thinking clearly. They're not thinking well. They have to think through the implications. And so we are forced in this gospel then to really be once again confronted with the fundamental issues of life. Jesus does not answer this question. And of course, the material and evil and suffering that can be derived from the biblical materials and resources help us understand some things about this. And I'm not going to go into that. I've got some tapes on the problem of evil and suffering if you're interested in that. And we've discussed that in other settings. But I will say simply that God Himself, though, is never accountable for the idea of committing an evil. But He does create the conditions in which there are free agents, that there are agents who do choose evil, and that while God is the ultimate cause, He is not the secondary cause. That is to say, He is never accountable for evil, though He allows it to happen in this world, but He underwrites the cost, and ultimately He will overcome it. Blindness would be evil in the sense, if you described it in the sense, that it would be a lack of a good thing. For example, it's not an evil thing for, say, a creature that is sightless and not to be able to see. For a stone, for a vegetable. But if we're dealing with a human being who has eyes for a purpose, then for them to have that deficiency would be a sign of evil in the sense of there's something wrong. It is a lack of a good thing in that regard. It would be a deficiency of a good thing. So the idea is that because even there, who sinned? They're immediately connecting it with sin. We must understand that in the new creation, there will be no blindness. That there will be no one will be lame, no one will be in a position where they will have physical deficiencies.
But He was blind so that a blessing might be shown.
What we're saying here is that a blessing will be shown in spite of his. He is blind, but Jesus is about to do the works of His Father that will manifest a blessing. But if it depends on how you translate that text. As I say, if we said, but so that the work of God might be displayed in His life, we must do the work of Him who sent me, then there's not that immediate connect. That's the idea. But as I go on here, Jesus goes on to say in verse 4, we must work the works of Him who sent me as long as it's day. Night is coming when no one can work. And so He says, you know, you have this short window of time. Don't we all recognize the very, very short window of opportunity that we have on this planet? That's why I'm fond of saying to people again that there are many things in heaven that we're going to be able to do, but two of the things we'll never, ever, ever be able to do again would be to share the gospel with people who do not know Christ, and secondly, to help people in conditions of desperate need. You'll never have that opportunity again. So it's important to realize that you have an arena of influence and an opportunity now, in this day, to become a manifestation, an agent, an ambassador of the King, and to be one who is a harbinger of reconciliation, 2 Corinthians 5, to reconcile people to God. And by doing that in such a way that we cultivate intentional relationships to serve people and love them and to become manifestations, living epistles in their lives. Jesus says, while I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. Again, that theme that we saw in John chapter 8, verse 12, that theme, I am the light of the world. So he reiterates that statement. While I am in the world, I'm the light of the world. And you can imagine at this point that the whole festival then, focusing on light, is something that he's really leveraging and using. Now, when he had said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied the clay to his eyes. A couple thoughts about this that I should point out. One thing is that blindness was a good deal more prevalent than you might suppose. They didn't have cures. They didn't have treatments that we now have. And also, it would be very easy for a person to have disease through dirty water and so forth and pollutants. And it would be very easy for a person to get some kind of a disease that cannot be treated because they didn't have the medical treatment for it. Blindness was not only prevalent, much more then than it is now, but secondly, it's also more debilitating. Today, if a person's blind, still there are resources for such a person. You have Braille, for example, that people have, and there are other things that can be used to help them, seeing eye dogs and things. In that culture, you didn't have work, you didn't have a position. It was like almost like an assignment of death. You're worse off than if you were a paralytic. I mean, it was an awful condition in that culture, and it was so debilitating. So it was almost like a sentence of death. You had to be completely then dependent, in this case, with his parents. But he says, He takes a spittle and applies it to his eyes. Now, I find that to be interesting because this spittle was actually something that was associated, by the way, with renowned people. It was an enormous superstition regarding the spittle of a renowned person. It was regarded as having magical properties at that time. And there was a lot of superstition. Think about this. If you did, without that medical aid, it would be very easy to form superstitions about ways of which a person can be healed, especially if you could find something that was an authenticated healing like this is can be authenticated. So it'll raise some questions. Did it really happen? So he spat on the ground, made clay of that spittle, applied the clay to his eyes, and then verse 7 said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. Significant here because Jesus, by the way, is described as the one who has been sent by God. Chapter 4, 5, and 7 and 8 all say, here's a man sent by God. So the one who was sent sends him to the sent. You see the idea, he sends him to the place called sent. So there's a play on words going on here. The blind man is being told to wash in the place called sent by the one who was sent by God. So the point is that Jesus is the source of his healing, not the pool. Now this pool of Siloam, by the way, was the only internal well of water that they had in the city of Jerusalem. And it's actually, though, it was made possible because after Hezekiah, he redirected the Gihon Spring, which was outside the city wall at that time, and actually dug this well, this tunnel, Hezekiah's water tunnel, through the city, through that, almost a mile long, which was an amazing feat, by the way. There's an account of how. Now think about how would you do this if they were digging from both ends and they met almost, they met in the middle. That's a hard thing to pull off when you think about it, going through sheer stone. And they there's a little bit of a point where they diverted a few feet when they heard each other going. Anyone ever go through that tunnel? It's a very strange experience. I've been there myself. I didn't like it, to be honest with you. One time was enough. Just a little crowded and so forth. There's some water in there. And it ends up then, that's where this pool is to be found. Not very big. There are points where it's about this wide and about this high, and sometimes you have to crouch, and sometimes it gets real narrow at a couple points. And frankly, you don't want to encounter people coming the other way, so they always go from the outside into the inside. There's a particular reason for that. You don't want to go try to go past each other. You see, you'd have what they'd call a Mexican standoff. You know, who goes backwards? But the It was an intriguing experience. As I said, once was enough. But that, by the way, was a brilliant thing because it made it possible for the people of Jerusalem to withstand a long siege because they had a water supply, and that was absolutely critical in that kind of a culture. So we have this portrait of a man who goes. And it says there that he went away and washed and came back seeing. It doesn't give us an account about his doubts, perhaps, and so forth. He probably wondered, is this true? Now remember, he hasn't seen Jesus yet. He went away, washed, and came back seeing. It reminds me of the story of Naaman and Elisha. And remember, Naaman comes down, and Elisha says, and didn't even bother coming out to meet him, and said he sends his servant out there and says, go dip in the Jordan River 7 times. The guy was outraged. I've come down all the way down from, he was this powerful captain of the Syrians. I've come all the way down from Syria. We got better rivers than this. And you tell me to go. At least I thought the prophet himself would come out and wave his hand over a few times and then he'd heal me. You know, he wanted some magical thing instead. But here's the point. His servant said, look, if the man had asked you to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? Just try it out. Now, can you imagine the first time he dips himself? Probably feels like a fool. Second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth time. Nothing's happened. Seventh time he comes out, his skin is like a baby. And he then comes back and wants to pay for it. And Elijah says, "Don't! I will not take a penny. Grace cannot be purchased." And so he goes back, though. And so there's an analogy here. Here's a man who at least went away and did as he said. So that's the first part of the narrative. Then we have the healing of the blind man. And then the second part of the narrative is in chapter 9, verses 8 to 34. This is the interrogation. And we see four basic moves. Verses 8 through 12, it's that their neighbors are involved. Then in 13 through 17, it's the Pharisees. And then we go to the parents are called in verses 18 through 23. And then after his parents, we go to the man. And he is now interrogated before the Pharisees until verse 34. So you have these three movements. And again, each of these things makes the case stronger and stronger. Because the natural question would be, is this the same guy who was born blind? Is he a lookalike? Secondly, was he really blind? Can his parents authenticate this? Who is this Jesus? Actually, after all, he healed what in what day? Sabbath. If he was of God, why would he heal on the Sabbath? Actually, as you know, that was not a violation of Torah. It was a violation of human tradition. But they were so wrapped up in their own human traditions that they'd virtually elevated that above grace, and they were more concerned that they violated their particular tradition than that a man was healed. We've seen this before, haven't we, in the Gospels, where he challenges them again and again. Chapter 5 is reminiscent of that discourse that we have. And so we see these themes here. And all this, let's take a look at the neighbors then, going back to verse 8 to 12. Therefore the neighbors and those who previously saw him as a beggar were saying, is not this the one who used to sit and beg? And there's a question of identity. Is this the right guy, first of all? In other words, we've seen him all his life. Others were saying, this is he. Still others were saying, no, but he's like him. He's a lookalike. Maybe something is a setup here. You can just see the doubt. Here's the poor guy saying, he kept saying, I'm the one. They're all talking about him. I'm the one. And they completely ignore him. So they were saying to him, how then were your eyes opened? In other words, if you're the one, how could your eyes have been opened? In other words, you've been born blind. How could it be that your eyes were open? He answered, a man who was called Jesus made clay. That's all he knows about him. He hasn't seen him yet, remember. All he knows is the name. A man who was called Jesus is all he knows about him. He made clay. He anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went away and washed, and I received sight. I'd love to have been there. Wouldn't it be great to see a man born blind who'd never even had that? We've seen people and know about people who've maybe lost their eyesight at some point, but here's a man who never saw it. It reminds me of the Mark 8 healing, which is intriguing. If you turn back to that just for a moment, though, there's a two-stage process that took place there, because it really, in a way, would require two miracles. Two stages, yeah, and this is intriguing. When they came to Bethsaida in Mark 8:22, they brought a blind man to Jesus and implored him to touch him. Taking the blind man by the hand, he brought him out of the village, and after spitting on his eyes and laying his hands on him, he asked him, do you see anything? And he looked up and said, I see men, for I see them like trees walking around. That's the first stage. And actually, it's quite plausible, because if a man were truly blind, he would be able now to see, but his problem would be his cognitive perception, because the brain has not been attuned to see and to shape those forms. That would be, in other words, be kind of chaotic. And so there's a second stage in this hearing, in this miracle. Then again he laid his hands in his eyes a second time, and he looked intently and was restored and began to see everything clearly. And he went and sent him to his home. I know of one ophthalmologist who came to faith by reading that text, because it says there's no way the ancient world would understand that two stage. What are your thoughts about that? Do you find that to be intriguing, Bill? I mean, I just find that to be astounding, that being an ophthalmologist, yeah. But that's a marvelous image that we have here. The miracle really is not only of the ability to see and to have the image in the retina, and then for that to go to the brain, the optic lobes, and so forth. But then there's the cerebral functioning that is required, the higher order functioning, to be able to make sense out of what you're seeing. That's exactly what happens. So we don't see exactly how all this happened, but they said to him then, "Where is he?" He says, "I don't know." He has no clue as to where Jesus is. So the first theme that we see here is that they were asking the wrong question. Instead of how, it should have been who. Who is this one? You want to find out who that one is. They were focusing more on the manner of healing and missing the message of the healing as well. You know, Jesus did it in different ways, because he healed two blind men by touching their eyes and one by putting spittle on his eyes. And though the healing power is the same, he can vary his methods. God really has a way of doing things in unique ways. But let's continue into the next part and looking at what the Pharisees say. They brought to the Pharisees the man who was formerly blind. And now, of course, John brings out this point. Now, it was the Sabbath on the day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. So that's their focal concern, is a violation of their particular law. Then the Pharisees also were asking him again how he received his sight. And he said to them, "He applied clay to my eyes, and I washed, and I see." So he's saying the same thing, same questions, answering again and again. "Therefore, some of the Pharisees were saying, 'This man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath.'" So you see, there's going to be a division here. "But others were saying, 'How can a man who is a sinner perform such signs?'" So there even was a division among the religious leaders, the Pharisees themselves. In other words, if this man were a sinner, God could not do such an amazing thing. Now the question will be, is this really the right guy? And was he really certifiably blind? How can we authenticate that? Now, they said to the man again, blind man again, "What do you say about him since he opened your eyes?" That's an interesting thought, isn't it? They're saying, they're sort of divided among themselves. What do you say? What do you conclude? So he said, "He's a prophet." So that's his next. First, he was a man called Jesus. Now he has concluded that he's a prophet. Because there's no way that a man who is a sinner could do what he's done, in other words. Now, they didn't go for that. But the point is that this is an upsetting and deliberately challenging concept to the religious leaders, but they were blinded by their bias, and they sought to discredit the miracle, assuming that somehow Jesus had switched beggars. That's what they're almost assuming. And so he goes on to say, the Jews then did not believe it of him that he had been blind and had received sight, until they called the parents of the very one who received his sight. So now they want to prove that this is not the real McCoy. They questioned him, saying, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? Then how does he now see?" Now, his parents were smart enough to know that they're being put into a box, because they're afraid of being put out of the synagogue if they say something that's displeasing to the leaders. So his parents answered them and said, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind." Notice how cautious they are. These are irrefutable statements. "But how he now sees, we don't know. Or who opened his eyes? We don't know. Ask him, he's of age, he'll speak to himself for himself." So they take it back and put it back on him. Ask him. Because his parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone confessed him to be the Christ or the Messiah, he was to be put out of the synagogue. You see, the problem we have in the scriptures again and again is one of fearing people. Isn't it true? Go back with me to chapter 7, verse 13 in John. Look at that verse. It says, "No one was speaking openly of him for fear of the Jews." Then jump ahead to chapter 12 and verse 42, and you'll see the same motif. "Nevertheless, many even of the rulers believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they were not confessing him for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue." So there was a tremendous power that they wielded over people. the power or the authority to put them out, to more or less excommunicate them, to disbar them from fellowship in the religious community. And so there was a real power that they wielded, so people were afraid. You know, though, as Proverbs 29:25 says, the fear of man brings a snare. I love Jeremiah 17 because there it tells us that blessed are those who fear the Lord, but cursed are those who fear men. Because those who fear men will stumble. It is a good thing to fear God. And that's why I tell people, you cannot really seek to be pleasing to God and impressive to people at the same time. You see what I'm saying? In other words, you will either play to an audience of one, or you'll play to an audience of many that are invisible. And so we're called to decide the audience to whom we play, and that makes all the difference in the world. And if you're doing it to be pleasing to God, and that is your fear, and that is your hope, that will be a far, far more powerful thing, because the focus of your heart now is on the spiritual and the eternal. But if you're doing it to impress people, the fear of man will bring you a snare, and you'll live for the present moment, and you will not have the fear of God. The problem we have is, and let's be very frank about this, don't we in practice often have a greater concern about what people would think if they caught us doing something than what God would think? Think about it while you look around before you do something stupid. The fact is that we know that God, at least we give intellectual lip service, don't we, to the idea that God's omniscient and omnipresent and knows your thoughts through and through, but we don't act upon that. The reason for it is at least people who are visible. That's why there's a power, by the way, in people in the idea of confessing your sins to one another and acknowledging, having accountability. There's something powerful about that, because if a person then invites another to hold him or her accountable for struggle areas in their life, and they've given that person freedom to do that, there can be a greater concern about that, then at least that's visible and palpable, and that's why accountability can be an effective thing. Yes, Gus.
I was going to say, even by throwing it back, the parent said, he's of age, he'll speak for himself, it also reinforces the power of the message of the man's testimony.
That's a true statement.
Yeah,
the man's testimony keeps coming back to his testimony at the end of the day. But here's the important point, though. The Pharisees are now at a point where they have demonstrated that, where the parents have demonstrated they can no longer say he's a lookalike. They cannot also say that this guy was not always blind. So now it's certifiable. Now they have the problem. It's been thrown back on him. He will give testimony, and he will not deny what he knows. In spite of the fact that there is a great fear, the man will stand firm on what he knows to be true and not waver. But that was a test for him. And it'll always be a test for us, because here's the thing. When you commit yourself to Christ, there will be potential consequences of persecution and so forth, as Jesus makes clear in John 15. And so there's always going to be in your life and in mine a period of testing to see, will we confess him before people? That's part of the idea. He stands firm and will not deny what he knows to be true. But the point is now they can no longer write this off. Now they have to say that the guy was just a sinner, that he couldn't have been a prophet. But there's still a division among them. Let's continue in our story. And so, in verse 24, a second time they called the man who had been blind. Now they've established that he was blind, that this was the right guy, and that his parents gave authority. But here's what they do. They put words in his mouth. Give glory to God. We know that this man's a sinner. In other words, agree with us. This is what you must confess. In other words, if you don't say this, you're out of here. Do you see the point? So they're effectively asking them to deny this man. I love his response. Whether he's a sinner, I don't know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. Now that's very good, because what can they say? I know that for sure. You can't write it off. The thing was done. I'm standing here to tell you. But then I love this, because they were not satisfied with that answer. So they said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? Hadn't they already asked him this question before? It's almost humorous here. Now, the response that he has, and I told you already and you didn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Now, he doesn't exactly endear himself to them. You don't want to become his disciples too, do you? That's a great line. How come you keep asking me this question? They reviled them and said, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. As if that would mean, therefore, that if you're a disciple of Jesus, you couldn't be a disciple of Moses. That's a big mistake. The reality is that Jesus came to fulfill the law of Moses, and so he did. And I promise you, Moses saw, as Abraham did, saw that day, and Moses would have responded to Jesus. You see the idea? And frankly, it's not an either or. That's why it's rather sad in Israel, for example, that you'll be denied citizenship, or you will not be allowed, regarded to be Jewish if you confess Jesus. If you claim to be a Messianic Jew, they will not allow you to be considered Jewish. You can be an atheist. I find that strange. A person can be an atheist and still be regarded as a Jew. But as soon as you confess Jesus, you're no longer a Jew. That ought to tell us something, shouldn't it? Because that's always the cutting edge, what we do with Jesus. Always the cutting edge. At the point at which we say, he's just a good man, a prophet, that sort of thing, that's one thing. But as soon as we acknowledge something more about him, that he is Messiah and the Son of the living God, now we have another story entirely. And that will be something that will divide people, because he knew that he would come and people would be divided over him. So we go on in the story. They reviled them and said, we're disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses. As for this man, we do not know where he is from, they say. Now, I like his response. It's almost he's getting the upper hand on him. And he says, the man answered and said to them, well, here is an amazing thing, that you do not know where he is from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he hears him. Since the beginning of time, it has never been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. But he's teaching them, you see. Now, he was a man called Jesus. Then he was a prophet. Now what is he? He has come from God. You see the development in his illumination, in his own reflection, in his insight? Now he knows he has come from God. If he was did not come from God, he could do nothing. Their response, you are born entirely in sins, and are you teaching us? So they put him out. Now, we don't know how permanent that putting out, it may have been for a short period of time, it may have been for a month, it may have been permanent, but the idea that it's intriguing to me that the word putting them out, by the way, in verse 35 is the same word put forth in 10:4, when he puts forth his sheep. He had to pay a price, but he made the right choice. Now, here's what happens then. He learns something more about Jesus after they put him out of the synagogue. Jesus heard, verse 35, that they had put him out. And finding him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? Now that's the next level, is it not? He was a prophet. I mean, he was a man called Jesus. He was a prophet. He has come forth from God. Now he's the Son of Man. Do you believe in the Son of Man? You understand at this point, at this moment, this man has never seen Jesus. You do understand that, don't you? That he hears that voice, though. That voice sounds familiar. But he's never seen the face of Jesus until now, the face of the one who healed him. Notice that Jesus sought him out just as in chapter 5, he sought out the man who was the paralytic. Remember, he sought him out and wanted to bring it to a closure. Because you see, the physical healing is not the point. That's trivial compared to the spiritual healing, and which is John's theme. It's one thing to heal a man physically, but it's another matter entirely for there to be the healing of the heart. That's the much higher miracle. He answered, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, and I love this, you have both seen him, and he is the one who is talking with you. Using that word, seen him, to a man who was born blind is very meaningful. You have both seen him, and now he is the one who is talking with you. In other words, you've already seen him in a spiritual sense, but now you're looking at him. His response, he doesn't waste a second, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. Couple thoughts about this. You see, the good shepherd cares for his sheep, and Jesus sought him out after they put him out of the synagogue. He knew his voice, he hadn't seen his face. Now he can see him. But it's not enough that he believed that he's a man called Jesus or a prophet, or even that he's a man of God. We've got to confess the truth that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And it was for this purpose, as I said in John 20, that the gospel was written. Do you know, in a very real sense, you and I are in that same place. We have not yet seen him, but we will. Though you do not see him, you believe in him and greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. You will see him face to face. And so I think about that image in 1 Corinthians 13:12. But now we see through a mirror or glass darkly, but then what does he say? Face to face. In 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 8 to 9, we don't see him now, but we still rejoice, and we will see him. Revelation 22:3-4, they will see his face. So we will see him, and that is a glorious hope and a very comforting thought. We'll see him. And by the way, I'll add this. When you see that face, you'll realize that's the wellspring of pleasure and joy that you were looking for all your life. You'll realize it was that face you were looking for all your life. You didn't fully know it, but when you see him, he will be the summary, the summation of all pleasures and all beauty and all truth and all goodness, all wrapped up in one, because he indeed is the author of the true, the beautiful, and the good. And somehow we'll see him in his resurrected body and see that fullness. It's a great and glorious thought that we might want to reflect upon. So the beggar admitted his need, in other words, and his eyes and his heart were both opened. Another point, he worshipped him, which is, of course, an evidence of his deity. Turn with me to Acts chapter 10, verse 25 to 26. This is very, very evident here. In Acts chapter 10, 25 to 26, you recall when Peter went to see Cornelius, the Roman centurion, because God sent him there? And in verse 25 of Acts chapter 10, Peter entered, Cornelius met him, fell at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter raised him up, saying, "Stand up, I too am just a man." No, don't worship me, I'm just a man. And then look also with me to Acts chapter 14. And in verses 11 to 15, Paul is in a situation where he has been at Lystra demonstrating the authority of God. And when the crowd saw what Paul had done after he raises up this man who was had never walked since his mother's womb, "Stand upright on your feet," and he leaped up and began to walk. The crowd saw that what Paul had done. They raised their voice, verse 11, saying in the Lyconian language, "The gods have become like men and have come down to us." And they began calling Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. The priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifice with the crowds. They thought these were the two of the great gods who had come down in human form. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they tore their robes and rushed out into the crowd, crying out, "Men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you and preach the gospel to you, that you should turn from these vain things to a living God, who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them." And so, again, they cannot accept worship. Then we turn to Revelation 19, and we see a similar picture, this time with an angel. In Revelation 19:10, verse 9, the angel says, "Write, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. These are true words of God." Verse 10, "Then I fell at his feet to worship him. But he said to me, 'Do not do that. I am a fellow servant of yours and of your brethren who hold the testimony of Jesus. Worship God.'" No angel will accept worship unless it's the living God, the angel of Yahweh. No man should accept worship. Although I'm sorry to say that in our own time, there have been many who've accepted that kind of adulation, people doing that, supposedly having that they're messiahs or any number of combinations thereof. But this is an evidence of his deity when he worshipped him. And I'm reminded, of course, as I jump ahead, when Thomas said the same thing. He fell at his feet, worshipped, and said, what did he say? "My Lord and my God." And Jesus didn't say, "Don't do that." In fact, he said that the Son of Man has come, verse chapter 5. Go back to chapter 5 for a moment and look at verse 23. When Jesus said he's given all judgment to the Son so that all will honor the Son even as they honor the Father. He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. So that word honor speaks really of the kind of honor that one would give to the living God. And he says the same honor is to be given to me as well. These are powerful claims. And so Jesus received the worship. He said in these words, "For judgment I came into this world, so that those who do not see may see, that those who see may become blind. So there's a bit of an irony there. That is to say, those who admit their need are those who will see. Those who refuse to see will then be still blind. And it's this idea then of seeing, and a person can see and not see and fail to acknowledge their need. On the 25th of this month, that's when the Passion of Christ will be shown on Ash Wednesday. You know the old claim that's been going around, that it's claiming that the Jews were the ones who did it. Frankly, the theme of the film will be that all of us did it. And my belief will be when you go out of there, you'll realize all of us did it. In fact, the point is, unless you admit that you were the one who did it, you'll never be in a position to really receive him. So that only when the whole point of the narratives are to demonstrate that it was the Jews and the Romans and Herod and Pontius Pilate, all of them were implicated because all of us were there. All of us. And that's why Rembrandt's wonderful painting of Christ on the cross, what do you see Rembrandt doing? He's up there, and he's one of those who are crucifying Jesus. You see, he sees himself as one of the guilty men. So it's a picture, it's a self-portrait of himself, of himself as one who would have done the same thing. It's this idea that we were there. And so understanding that, then, you have this option. There are two options you've got. One way that you do not see, of course, is because you are simply blind, and you need to see. But there's another form of blindness, and this is the deeper one. Those who refuse to look. And that is where we go into people then who really, that there would be a kind of an apostasy, a true apostasy. A true heresy, a true apostasy is when a person who may have experienced or heard the gospel and finally says no, and says no too many times. And there are examples of those in our own time. That's why I like C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, because, as you know, he describes a busload of people who come from hell to heaven to check it out and see if they want in. they all opt to go back except for one. But the point is, the roster of tourists is as many intellectuals as it does base heathen. The fact is that hell will have more than its share of thoughtful theologians. And so the idea here is there's going to be a lot of people who reflected hard but rejected Jesus. And so it's one thing to know about him, it's another thing to reject him outright. It's another thing just to refuse to acknowledge him and bow the knee before him. So he was put out of the synagogue. Then Jesus has his discourse with them. So he found him, he worships him. Jesus said then, "For judgment I came into this world, so that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind." Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things, and they said to him, "We are not blind too, are we?" Now, this is one of Jesus' great statements here. If you were blind, you would have no sin. But since you say we see, your sin remains. Now, that's a pretty strong, powerful refutation. I don't know how they responded to that, but I'm sure it didn't make them happy. The fact is that if you acknowledged your spiritual blindness, then your sin problem would be done away with. But because you say we see, you refuse to receive the light you've been given, your sin now remains. There is a price to be paid. So this man is really a sort of a disciple of Jesus who now comes to a full understanding of him, and now he responds as he should. And he's an illustration of a man whose physical blindness is now overcome, and now he is also in his heart capable of seeing, whereas those who should have seen the truth blinded themselves to it. And so there's this reversal. And all on the day, on the last day of Tabernacles, the Festival of Light. It's a festival that involved light and light illuminating. So there's a double meaning. But you, the reader, remember, are forced to react, what do I do with this Jesus? Do I align myself with him? Would I be willing, for example, to confess him before people who are also skeptics and would deny him? You see, that's the issue we have to raise. Any closing thoughts or questions on this chapter? I just love this chapter because of the wonderful narrative drama and the flow. Yes, John?
Quick question. That 39, he says, "For judgment I came into this world," versus chapter 3, 17, "I did not send the Son of the world to judge the world."
Here's what we have here. If we go back to chapter 3 for a moment, This is the judgment, verse 19, that the light has come into the world, and men love the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. In fact, you can regard our chapter as a commentary on that verse. Now, earlier he said that he who believes in him is not judged. He who does not believe has been judged already, because he has not believed in this name of the only begotten. In other words, they're judging themselves. They're putting themselves in a position of judgment, because he goes on to say in verse 20, everyone who does evil hates the light, does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light so that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God. The point is this. I've come in this coming to provide an option. I did not come to condemn the world, but to give them an opportunity, an option for life. But if they reject that option, they have judged themselves. And then they have one who will judge them. And again in Revelation, we see now Jesus is coming, one who comes in authority, majesty, and judgment. He comes now as the Pantocrator, as the Orthodox call him, the judge of the earth. Yes.
In 39, that's what you say. You guys are getting a choice here.
Yeah. And
that's
the judgment. And you have, and really, as I say, if you connect chapter 9 with these verses in chapter 3, you have the chapter 9 is a commentary on John chapter 3, verses 17 through 21. And that, it in turn, follows, if you go back to John chapter 1, verse 8, speaking of John, he was not the light, but he came to testify about the light. There was the true light which coming into the world enlightens every man. And then, of course, this idea earlier than that, the life was the light of men, verse 4, the light shines in the darkness. The darkness did not apprehend or comprehend it. So the idea here is that you have a darkness that cannot understand the things of God and rejects those things because the deeds are evil. But those who, by the grace of God, respond to the offer, then acknowledge, and here's the point, they must acknowledge their darkness, their blindness, before they can receive the light. If you say you see, your sin remains. So this commentary on the Pharisees then is a commentary as well on the reader. Okay, here's what we're going to do next week. The great chapter about the Good Shepherd. We're going to be looking at that, and it has some very interesting implications. And sorry to say, this is one of those passages that New Agers use all the time about the idea of, didn't I say you're all gods? See, we're all gods. Popular text, so we'll talk about how that really does not follow and why that's a misuse of that text. At the end of the day, it always comes down to the person of Jesus, though, as I kind of draw my conclusions.
To order additional copies of this CD or other selections from Ken Boa's teachings, call 800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 800-372-9632. Or contact us through the Reflections Ministries website at www.reflectionsministries.org.